When I was little, I would pretend to be a hero. My toy box was full of capes, fire trucks, and army gear. But now life is complex. But what makes a hero remains constant. A hero defies the odds, stands strong, does what's right, even when it's not easy, particularly when it's not easy. But when faced with an unplanned pregnancy, men are told we don't have a voice. But that doesn't feel right. Shouldn't we be there? Help her? Protect her? One day our sons and daughters will ask, "What did you do?" And we want them to know that we stepped up. We supported their mother. We became fathers. And fathers can be heroes when they do what's right, even when it's not easy.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to Positively Pro-Life, a podcast brought to you by the Pennsylvania Pro-Life Federation. On this podcast, we aim to bring you inspirational stories and conversation, important legislative updates and informative interviews as we seek to restore and strengthen a culture of life. I'm your host, Remel Tenney, Education Director at the Federation, and joining me is my co-host and Executive Director, Maria Gallagher. Welcome, Maria.
Thank you so much, Remel. It's great to be with you on the program.
It's always great to have you. And today's guest is a remarkable woman whose dedication and contribution to the pro-life movement is unparalleled. She was responsible for forming the Association for Interdisciplinary Research in Values and Social Change that enabled academicians to conduct the very first studies on the effects of abortion on women in society. And it provided credence to the anecdotal stories that post-abortive women had been sharing all along. So you are going to want to stick around for this conversation. But first, as always, let's listen to Maria's weekly update.
Thank you so much, Remel. It was like a family reunion, but the attendees were united by belief, not blood. The event was a pro-life retreat and conference in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. It united leaders of statewide and regional pro-life organizations dedicated to the proposition that all human life is precious and should be protected. The Sisters of Life gave a phenomenal reflection on how to position our hearts for the immense challenges of today. With a winsome spirituality, the sisters led people of all different faith traditions in a meditation on our unique call to the pro-life movement. Meanwhile, worship leader Robert Albino's vocals soared above the crowd for rousing renditions of Amazing Grace and How Great Thou Art. Professor Michael New of the Catholic University of America offered some sobering statistics, while Laura Echevarria, Director of Communications and Press Secretary of National Right to Life, provided some fascinating insights on messaging in a post-Dobbs world. The event was the brainchild of former State Representative Paul Schemmel, who organized and strategized to help make the retreat a success. The retreat called to mind the time I felt called to pro-life leadership. It happened at an Irish dancing festival in the Catskills, where a wise elderly Irish priest gave an incredible homily on the sacredness of life. Once I heard that talk, I knew in my heart I had to do more for the pro-life movement. I highly recommend a retreat to help to recharge your batteries and prepare for the daunting tasks which lie ahead. Victory is in our future, but we must be prepared for the pitfalls we will find along the way. Remel.
Thank you, Maria, for that wonderful update. It's always edifying to hear when members of the pro-life movement across the Commonwealth come together and are unified in continuing to fight for life, where we know what the message is, where we know what the current state is. And thank you so much for also just giving us an opportunity to know that this is part of what the Federation was involved in, and that we were present and we were Very, very happy to be working and collaborating with so many others in life-saving efforts across the Commonwealth. So, thank you for that. Now, our guest today, Wanda France, is a development psychologist and professor emerita of child development in the Division of Family and Consumer Sciences at West Virginia University in Morgantown. She has been a lifelong pro-life advocate whose efforts to educate others about the abortion issue began when she joined the West Virginia Right to Life Club back in 1971 as a graduate student. Dr. France served as president of West Virginians for Life from 1975 to 1990 and as president of National Right to Life Committee from 1991 to 2011. She currently serves as the president of West Virginians for Life, and we are excited to have this conversation with her. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. France.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
You have had such an impressive track record on fighting for life. And I just wanted to point, I mean, it's so impressive that you started advocating for life as a young woman before Roe v. Wade made abortion legal. Now, where did that conviction about the sanctity of life come from?
Well, when I was a child, my father, who was a military officer, was stationed in Germany after the World War II. And at the time, the horrors of the German abortion, the German Holocaust of the Jews, was very prominent, and we were being encouraged to learn about it. And at the time, in fact, all of the films that had been taken of the concentration camps were shown to the military families in Germany at the time. And it made a very big impression on me, and I was very concerned, as was everyone else, about how it came to happen that the Germans did such horrible things to their fellow human beings. And I finally came to the conclusion myself that they had, once they had made a decision to change the humanity of one portion of the human population so that those people were seen as less than human, it really opened the door to everything. It opened the door to the Holocaust. And so I was very concerned, and I remember very distinctly promising God that if there was ever a problem like that starting in the United States, that I would start early, and I would become involved so that we could work to prevent something from happening to the extreme that we saw in Germany. And of course, at the time, I immediately thought, well, but America's different. There isn't, we wouldn't do anything like that. And I really kind of forgot about that incident. But when the issue of abortion came up, it just was so important. I was a child development student at the time, and I just felt that I, had to get involved. And of course, I deep inside my memory was that memory of the I wasn't at the top of my memory at the time, but I began to be involved in the pro-life movement and working against the development of an abortion culture. And so I bring it all back to my realization and understanding that you can't deny the life of any one person without it affecting the world.
Wanda, what inspired you to dedicate your life to the pro-life cause after that initial awakening, as it were, to the atrocities of World War II?
Well, I was, I think that it wasn't a real conscious recognition in the beginning that I was keeping my promise to God at the time, but I realized that my husband was German, and We had, you know, he was very aware of the same kinds of issues that I was. And so when the issue of abortion came up and we began to address it at our church, you know, early before Roe v. Wade, it was one of those things that we felt very strongly about. And when I saw the notice in my church bulletin that the organization was meeting, you know, at the church that week, I said to my husband, I guess I'm going to have to go. And my husband said, yeah, I guess you probably are. And I remember thinking, darn, I wish he had tried to talk me out of it. but he, you know, was with me in terms of our mutual understanding of how terrible this issue was going to be for the country. And so I went to the meeting, and that, you know, we just continued to work and taking it one step at a time, developing the organization in West Virginia and nationally and internationally.
Wow, that is incredible. And of course, that led you to be the president of the National Right to Life at one point. And in your work, one of the things that you did was fill in the gaps about the effects of finding the effects of abortion on women and society by facilitating these kind of studies, right? And we know that even now to this day, there are the pro-abortion groups attempt to discredit or avoid any research that talks about the harms of abortion to women and families and the society. Can you tell us why do you think that is? Especially because you saw the need and you did something about it, but you have a lot of opposition to that kind of work. Why do you think there is opposition to the research being conducted on post-abortive women and their experiences?
Yes, I have to say I was very disappointed almost immediately with the research that was being done by people in my field, you know, the psychologists and others working to try to promote the fact that women presumably were not having negative effects. And, mm-hmm. for example, some of the earliest research that was being touted by the media came from Planned Parenthood, and what they were doing was taking women who had been in the had abortions and were recovering in the abortion facilities, and they went to them while they were in recovery and just did a brief interview and would say, you know, how are you feeling? What is your attitude about this? Do you think this was the right thing? You know, what you're going to do with your life? And that's those sorts of questions. And they always reported, every time they reported, almost 100% of the women would say that they were sad and that they, you know, that was always there. And they would always report that in the study. But then they would completely ignore that and go on and talk about what the women said about feeling relief and feeling the need to get on with their lives and some of those sorts of crisis resolution responses that you get when you're in a crisis and that you believe has been resolved. And then in the articles, they would say, well, you know, so-and-so percent of these women, whatever it was, and it was often fairly high, were unhappy. But over the long haul, over the long haul, that dissipated, that would go away. And it was just always this kind of throwaway line that would show up in all the discussions in these papers. And the reality was that they weren't following up with these women. The studies they were doing were just simply quickie studies that had been done because they had access to these women, but they never went back and tried to, you know, to do the long-term follow-up that would have justified them making the statement. And it was so obviously I mean, just from the point of view of research methodology, it was just horrible methodology, and it was unethical, and the newspapers never reported the negative aspects of the studies. They just always said, oh, these women are great, they're having a wonderful time, you know, they've resolved their problem, and now they're going on with their lives, but they never actually knew what happened to the women. And when they started doing the long-term follow-ups, it turned out that most of the women were not willing to do interviews to follow up from the abortion, and that the fact that they weren't accepting interviews was an indication that they probably were not doing well. Because, you know, if you feel good about something, you're happy to talk about it. And so some of these studies, these long-term studies, had like 60-70% rates of failure to repeat the, you know, the long-term study. And you were dealing with like 20 or 30% or 40% of women who had been in the original study who were willing to even talk to you. And then from that study, they weren't all doing as well as either. But you know, the majority of them would have still been saying, I'm fine, everything's okay, I'm in college, whatever. So it was the most frustrating thing in the world to realize that people who understood something about research methodology were not taking these studies to task, and the media was picking up on them immediately. And when we subsequently had these absolutely amazing studies with huge sample sizes and excellent research methodology and, you know, the analysis, none of those papers received the kind of attention from the media. And yet they were the studies that were the most, you know, effective from the point of view of methodology. In the end, we have found, and I think this is a statement anybody could make, that 55%, and this comes from a meta-analysis of all this international research that had been done in the interim in these last 20 years, that demonstrated, you know, that women were having problems. And in that research, 55% as a result of the meta-analysis, 55% of the women had difficult, long-lasting mental health problems from the abortion. And so the idea that women aren't having negative impacts goes against everything we know in the pro-life movement from knowing women who have had abortions. But this research that is really quality research is not being reported by the media. And I charge the media at being in cahoots with these researchers to try to promote abortion to women in the country. And it's doing such a horrible disservice to women.
Definitely. Now, Wanda, what were some of the highlights of your time as president of National Right to Life?
Well, I think the national conventions that we had regularly and the opportunity to get together with researchers at our association meetings was certainly a highlight. And one of the things that I feel has been one of the most important things in trying to promote an understanding of the impact that abortion has on women. But there were certainly a lot of other opportunities to meet pro-life people from around the country, and it was, you know, wonderful to be able to go travel to the different states and speak about the pro-life issue around the country, and to meet so many wonderful people who care about life and respect the dignity of every person. And I think pro-life people are the greatest people. They are so wonderful and welcoming, and And I certainly appreciated that as a very important part of what I did as a president of National.
Wow. And in your experience, I'm sure you've seen a lot. And I was just wondering, can you tell us right now, when you're looking back, what do you see has changed in the abortion landscape since you started fighting for life all those years ago?
Well, of course, when Roe v. Wade first came down, it was a terrible shock. And people in the country had no idea that this was coming. And so it meant that we were kind of caught unawares without any preparation, although I know that I had given some talks at the university, and there was that initial pro-life organization that had started before Roe v. Wade, because there were states around that had started to make abortion available in the early trimester. And so it was very difficult time, because we had to come up with strategies that were very complex, because Roe v. Wade as a constitutional amendment prevented us from passing any kind of legislation that would actually stop abortions directly. And it was so hard for people to understand that. They said, well, how can that be? You know, this is America. Why can't we just go pass a law? And because of the Supreme Court decision, we couldn't. If we passed a law, the courts would knock the laws down as being unconstitutional. And so this absolutely terrible attack on our Constitution was with us for 50 years. And that, excuse me, that was one of the saddest things about Roe v. Wade, was that the Constitution of the United States of America actually legally allowed the direct killing of another human person. I mean, that was just the idea that was constitutional in America was really awful to think about. And that was when I began to think back and realize that I had indeed promised to get involved in an with the opposition to efforts to undermine the dignity of human life beginning in the womb. And that once you start that, I knew from my experience in Germany that it wouldn't stop there, that it would go to euthanasia and so forth. And so we had many predictions to make at the time, and everybody laughed at us, and the media scorned us, and we had really very difficult time getting our message out, you know, in the beginning. So that was kind of the impact, you know, the way the movement was working at the time. It was very difficult. We had a lot of debates and arguments about what our strategy should be and so on. So when Roe v. Wade was overturned, it of course opened up the possibility to begin to pass laws to actually directly oppose abortion. And I think the difference is that we have an organization, a nationwide organized entity called the pro-life movement. They're not all in one group, you know, or one organization, but it's a national recognized entity that is there and available to begin to make the changes that we need to make. And so that's the huge difference, is that we never gave up. We were always there, you know, for 50 years. We continued to work to try to bring about the overthrow of Roe, and which we have. But now, of course, we still have a huge job ahead of us, because all of the states are need to be working as hard as they can to make the changes that the overthrow of Roe has made possible.
In the few minutes we have left, can you tell our listeners where you were when Roe versus Wade was overturned?
I remember exactly because we were at the National Right to Life Convention, and I was sitting in a session that was devoted to the end-of-life issue, the physician-assisted suicide euthanasia issue that we've been forced to address, and everybody has recognized that we were right in the beginning to say that this is the direction it would go in. So it was a kind of poignant thing to be in a session like that when we heard about the overthrow of Roe, that our need to work to protect life had begun with the womb, but was being extended to elderly, sick, and disabled people. And so, I think in retrospect, it was a rather impressive that it happened, came, the doors flew open, and the people started shouting that Roe was overturned. And of course, when you have a conference room full of couple hundred pro-life supporters, it was wonderful. It was wonderful to be with them, and people were crying and laughing and congratulating each other, and it was a really special moment.
Well, if you were to give the best argument for life in one sentence, what would it be?
Well, I think that in my experience over these years, I think that the reality, the truth that every life is an individual life that has been created in the image of God and is therefore should be respected and cared for is the fundamental emphasis that we should have in our movement, and I believe that it'll be necessary for us to begin to recognize that God's gift of life to us, to the human race, is something that should be cherished and not thrown away.
Wanda Franz of West Virginians for Life, thank you so much for being on Positively Pro-Life today.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Positively Pro-Life is made possible through the generous support of the members of the Pennsylvania Pro-Life Federation all across the Commonwealth. Thank you for joining us, and remember, there is always a reason to choose life.